Macro Trading Floor.
With me, Alfonso Peccatiello, founder of the Macro Compass and former head of investments at a large European bank.
And I am Brent Donnelly, president of Spectrum Markets. I've been a portfolio manager, day trader, and market maker at the biggest commercial and investment banks in the United States. I'm also the author of Alpha Trader and The Art of Currency Trading. If you want to know what's going on in markets and where they're going, you found the right podcast.
Hey everyone, Alf here. The Macro Trading Floor is back again this week as well. And back with me, my good friend and co-host, Brent Donnelly. Brent, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm good, Alf. How are you been?
Good, good. You're back from holidays. Lucky guy, you know, taking a week off while we work.
Yeah, it wasn't much of a holiday. It was just family trips to Canada. It's nice to see the family, but it's definitely not a holiday.
Fair enough. I get that. So let's talk about markets a bit, which are boring as hell, but still we can figure out something fun to talk about, starting from Mr. Waller at the Federal Reserve. And I know you have an opinion there.
Yeah. So I have a lot of respect for Waller. Like, I've met him a few times and he's just like a pretty pragmatic dude. He's a nice guy, like pretty down to earth. He's not like, I wouldn't say he's like the prototypical negative view of people that people have of the Fed, of these like PhD ivory tower kind of people. I don't feel like he's really like that. He's much more pragmatic, but still it shows a perfect example of the over-communication by the Fed can lead to unwanted outcomes. Now, I don't want to ascribe everything that's happened in the last 4 months to one speech from Waller, but definitely his speech in November, where he said we could cut in 3, 4, 5 months, lit a fire under risky assets. It was the bottom for break even on inflation. And in the end, commodities have gone up a lot too, which is the primary headline source of inflation. So now we're in a situation where he then came out last night. So in November 2023, he kind of, to me, signaled the Fed pivot, took hikes off the table, and said we could cut in 3, 4, 5 months if inflation results are satisfactory. And now it's, you know, 4 months later, and he's essentially giving the same message, which is cuts will be about 4 months out. 4 or 5 months out, and there's no rush. There, basically, that was the name of the speech, was there's no rush. And to me, it's a little bit like when I was a kid, I was fascinated by, I don't know if you've seen this, if everyone's seen this, but the mirages on the highway when it's really hot and you see the mirage out in the distance. And I remember being obsessed thinking like, will we ever get there? Will we ever get there? But it's always, you know, like half a mile ahead. It's an optical illusion. The physics of which are actually quite interesting if you want to Google it. But I feel like the Fed rate cuts is a little bit like that, where it's like 3 or 4 months, kind of like Tesla self-driving. Like it's coming in 1 year ever since 2015 or whatever. And sure, it will come one day, and that doesn't mean it won't, but it just keeps on rolling. So I think it's an interesting kind of setup where there's essentially two central bank regimes. One is they're on autopilot for whatever reason, where they're doing, you know, 25 basis point hikes over and over and over, or they're not on autopilot and they're following the data. And when they're following the data, I think you have to really downgrade the speeches and what they're saying and the forward guidance, because it's just a snapshot of what the person's thinking at that given moment. And it can change quite rapidly, as it has with Waller. And so I think that's a framework to work within right now, is that really the data is driving the bus. And then the central bank obviously is kind of going to put some color around what their framework is, and you still need to read the speeches. But in the end, it's just the data that matters.
I think you're right. With one small caveat, that the volatility around the Fed decision is relatively small. As in, I think that the data is in driving seat too, but I'm also pretty much convinced they want to start a cutting cycle before the election campaign goes very much into the heat. So I think that they would really want June or July to be the starting date, so they can, you know, deliver one or two cuts before the election cycle goes into the heating part of it. What comes after that, you know, that's up for debate, I would say. That's the way I see now the framework of the Federal Reserve. And obviously, I mean, if data is very hot, they won't cut in June. That's pretty clear. But I think that they want to do that if they are allowed to. And then what comes after, well, I mean, the market is pricing six cuts in total by September 2025. So that's 18 months and six cuts. Can't really say that there is a ton priced in anymore. There is like a regular, pretty shallow cutting cycle for 18 months. And it could be that they do two or three, like in 1995, and then they just stop, you know? It could as very well be that type of outcome. But the volatility around their decision-making, I would say, between the end of 24 and beginning of 2025 can be there, but I don't think it can be a lot. And it also explains why market bond market implied vol has been coming down a lot, Brent. I mean, they are still in a sort of a predictable environment where they're going to end up doing three cuts or six cuts, but it's in the next 18 months. But roughly the market probably sits and trades around that.
Right. I mean, I think ultimately that's a great point, because ultimately bond market and Fed funds volatility is so low now that it's in a range of, like, the cone of uncertainty is very narrow. Like, what we had a year and a half ago was we thought they were going to maybe hike four or five times and they in 25 basis increments. And then all of a sudden we're talking about 50 and 75 point increments. Yes. And volatility through the moon if you look at 1 month bond vol. And now 1 month bond vol is at like 2 year lows or something like that. But do you think the Fed is worried about, like, they don't really seem to be mentioning it, but do you think they should, or do you think they are, or do you think they should be worried about, you know, NYMEX crude's trading at $83 again. Mm-hmm. Gas prices are, I think, two year highs, somewhere around there. RBOB and all that stuff is at the 2 year highs. So do you think, one, do you think they're worried about it? And two, do you think they should be?
I think they are not particularly worried about it, because they can always talk core inflation if they want to disentangle that problem away. What they cannot talk out is housing. If housing restarts, right, Brent, then they can't talk that out. It's 40% of the core CPI basket. So I'm watching housing closely, because it was supposed to come down aggressively with the increase in mortgage rates. All that happened is that certain cohorts of the housing market have basically frozen. There was no transactions pretty much, and certain overheated area of the housing market outside the US and even in the US have cooled. But that's it. That's all that happened. And actually, if the story is that there is, you know, this excess household savings and spending power and fiscal deficits are still flowing, could we not make the case that it could flow as well into the housing market and restart some animal spirit there? In principle, we could try and make the case there as well. And if we do, then that's a thing I'm looking at very, very closely to understand whether the Fed is, you know, really has to pull on the brakes again. But on NYMEX and crude oil and other stuff, I think they can always say, you know, we can look through it, it's volatile, we focus on core inflation. I think that's probably what they will do.
Right. And ultimately, I do think people tend to overestimate how much they care about most financial asset prices, like other than housing. You know, there people say, well, financial conditions are loose, they should be hiking because GameStop is going up and DJT is going up or whatever. But in the end, the philosophy always back to Greenspan was, we don't know what's a bubble. We'll just mop it up after it blows up, and we're not going to try to fine tune that stuff. But the thing is, I think you're right about housing. And then if you overlay stuff like Zillow rents or any kind of market-based measure of housing or rents, all those things have bottomed, and they're not like shooting higher, but they're definitely not going to be creating a disinflationary environment from here on in. But I think another question, I don't know if I can ask you this many questions, but
you can ask whatever you want, mate.
Do they actually care? And so, like, if they're projecting 2.4 core PCE or headline PCE, and they're projecting three cuts, and then they're projecting 2.1 for 2025 and more cuts, do they actually care that much whether core PCE is 2.9 or, I mean, obviously they care if it's significantly below two, we've seen evidence of that, but do they actually care if it's 2.4 or 2.9 or 2.7? It almost seems like maybe they don't. And then you can get into like conspiracy theories about monetizing the debt and all that stuff, but that's maybe 2% is sort of like the target, but do they actually care if it's 2.7? I don't know.
I mean, other central banks like Switzerland or Australia have a wider inflation band, right? They don't target exactly 2%, but a wider band. The Fed hasn't moved that yet, but, you know, the looser the interpretation, the more people are going to ride on that theme, right? And there are people saying the reason why gold and commodities and basically all financial assets linked to inflation or linked to nominal growth are going higher is because the Fed just revised their SCP saying that core inflation will be 2.6 by year end, core PCE. Nevertheless, yep. They're still projecting cuts. I mean, what does this say about the reaction function? And I think there is a point to be made here, Brandon, that I think it's also political, to be frank. I mean, they want to get the cutting cycle started before elections. And I understand why, you know, you are not seen as interfering if you start right into the elections. If you start 4 or 5 months earlier than the elections, then maybe it can be seen as a less of a political move, for instance. But in general, it's a very, very valid topic. I don't think the Fed has changed their inflation target because it's pretty simple. If you don't get to 2% first, you're going to lose all your credibility if you change your goalpost before achieving your goalpost. You know, that doesn't work. This would be like a striker for Real Madrid not scoring for an entire La Liga and then saying the year after, well, can we make the goalpost bigger, please? Because I need to score. I mean, that doesn't work, right?
I made some sweet passes.
Yeah, so it's basically the same. I don't think they've changed it, but they're running on a very fine line here because people are starting to interpret the reaction function as proactively lose, and economists are forecasting nominal GDP growth this year in the US at 4.7%. I repeat, 4.7%. I mean, real GDP forecast today is 2.2, which is above standard estimates of potential growth, real growth in the US. 2.2 is a respectable GDP growth. That's above any standard potential estimate. And then core PCE is in at 2.5 by year end. And the Fed is still cutting on the backdrop of this.
And maybe that's probably the best explanation for gold and Bitcoin and everything is that, they tighten policy, but policy's still loose. But the funny thing is that they won't admit that it's loose. So anyways, let's move on to, I want to talk a bit about BOJ because I think it's really interesting. I was off last week, obviously, but I think it's interesting from a bigger picture point of view that we had so many people, so obviously I work in FX, so many people trying to do the dollar yen down trade on BOJ normalization. And this isn't hindsight, like I was saying the whole time, like BOJ is just these tiny, tiny microscopic movements. And what really moves dollar yen is US rates, because that's where the juice comes from. That's where the beta in the yield differential comes from.
Yeah.
And so we got another example of that, which there have been many examples where the BOJ now hiked and dollar yen went up and it should have gone down in theory if you were just trading the BOJ as your framework. And so the reason I think it's interesting is that I think you have to have a really good explanation of the market that you're trading in order to make a good forecast. So it sounds maybe a little bit obvious, but I think I used to kind of overemphasize always thinking about the future and thinking about where's this market going to go and what's this market going to do. But I didn't always used to spend enough time just trying to nail down what's actually driving the market now. And if you don't do that, then you can start trading current accounts in Norway or whatever, you know what I mean? Because that's an appealing intellectual exercise, but there's no relationship between the Norwegian krona and the size of Norway's current account for many reasons. So I think this is a good example of having the right framework is a lot more important than being a really smart analyst, because you can analyze all the stuff you want, but if you're analyzing the wrong variables, then in the end, you're going to be wrong.
Yeah, it's a great thought. I think as well that factors affecting a certain financial asset can also change over time. They might be the same explanatory factors, but they will affect pricing in a different way. So we were talking about gold, right, before the podcast started. And the usual framework people use for gold is, well, I look at US real yields, right? It's the same trade. If real yields are going up, then gold is going down and vice versa.
Yeah.
And the idea there is sound, I would say. I mean, gold is seen as an alternative to, or a coexistent alternative to fiat money. If the real yield I can make on my fiat money is higher, then gold as an alternative will have a harder time, right? And gold prices will be going down and vice versa. It's just a substitution effect, basically an alternative between fiat money and gold.
Right, because gold is negative carry. It's kind of like a tax. You're paying an insurance tax to own gold.
Yeah.
Whereas if T-bills are 5% and you want a safe haven, you know, you can get T-bills at 5% or gold at minus 0.5%, right? So go ahead.
That's correct. It's exactly how it works. And then all of a sudden we see the fact real yields now have been above 1% for what, like I think 2 years or something in the US, and gold has been making new highs. And then this simple framework all of a sudden doesn't work anymore. You know, it would have, you would have been wiped out aggressively over the last 2 years being short gold the whole time, and it rips in your face. And then you need to figure out what the hell is happening. Like, what is the market driver that is behind gold that I'm missing here? And now we talked about the Fed being seen as proactively accommodating despite nominal growth being higher. That's an everything rally. It lifts all type of assets, including assets without a cash flow like Bitcoin or gold, because it's an animal spirit type of market. You know, the Fed is easing, but nominal growth is strong. Animal spirits everywhere. That's driving gold. We could talk about, I don't know, foreign central banks being buying gold, diversifying away from their treasury holdings because, you know, Russia was frozen with the reserves. And then maybe China is thinking, what the hell, should I buy some gold instead of having only treasuries as my FX reserves? And so on and so forth. But trying to explain how the drivers move and change and not being married by one single macro explanatory framework that you have can be a lifesaver sometimes, as it can trying to predict, try not to predict. This is something we discussed. I want you to elaborate on that, Brent. Not to predict when macro regimes are going to change. So here we're talking about low vol or high vol. We're now in a low vol environment. And Brent, tell us a bit, how does a trader feel or behave in a low vol environment? What does he want to do normally?
Right. So I remember, like, when I was in my 20s or my 30s, my instinct right now, if I was 20, say I was 32 years old right now, my instinct right now would be to want to fade everything, like fade the, especially the carry rally. People have been making money in Mexico for 2 years. It's like a free lunch, right? It's a 3.5 sharp, I think your thing said today.
Yeah.
You're getting a positive fundamental story, high carry and appreciation on the currency. So it's a total free lunch. So it feels too good to be true. But then what I've learned over many years, many painful experiences, is that these regimes go on and on and on and on. And it's, I think, essentially impossible to predict the end of these regimes, but it's much easier to know it when you see it, or to have some kind of, I think we discussed a couple of weeks ago, have some kind of technical indicators or trend indicators that will allow you to say, okay, whatever was happening before isn't happening anymore. And for me as a trader, like the thing you said about real yields decoupling from gold, or it was the same thing with NASDAQ, right? NASDAQ was the ultimate long duration asset. So when yields went up, NASDAQ got crushed in 2022. And then all of a sudden, if you look at a chart of real yields in NASDAQ, there it's like a big crocodile jaw, just the same as gold. And one thing that I've found over the years is that when something like that breaks down, like a normal relationship that you kind of rely on breaks down, that has so much signaling power, because like basically if you find yourself saying, oh, something weird is going on here, you have to really dig deep into that. Or sometimes it's not even like, you can't even necessarily come up with a great explanation for why it's happening, but it's just the what that matters more than the why. So like, when you see, okay, gold doesn't give a crap about real yields anymore, that's a signal. It's a signal that something's interesting and something is going on. And it's funny because like, if you look at the gold versus GLD flows, GLD flows, which is usually a retail kind of indicator, have been very negative and going down, but gold has been going up. And so there's a story there, which is the central bank story. But then if you go to the crypto area, there's different stories, like the halving and the ETF, maybe switcheroo out of gold into Bitcoin. And then if you go to NASDAQ, there's a story, AI and all that. But in the end, a lot of it's a debasement trade. And that's why I kind of laugh when people put like charts of the debt and like, oh my God, this is the end of the world. Debasement isn't bearish. Debasement is usually bullish. So, you know, and the funny thing is when you see people put those charts of long-term debt, they never put, it's like putting the debt of a company and saying, oh my God, this company's screwed. But like, oh, whoops, a balance sheet has two sides. And so the assets, it's not a mathematical certainty, but in general, US assets and debt tend to kind of go up together. So anyways, all that to say, when things start decoupling, because I watch a lot of correlation stuff for my trading, I find very often there's information there.
Yeah. And it's always hard, Brent, because sometimes stuff decouple and it's a good mean reversion opportunity, right? Because they're decoupling for no strong reason. And then you can try and play that. Or they're decoupling because there is something else going on, which is probably a trend. It's a new explanatory variable. It's something else. And I think people want to try and find the secret sauce. I was speaking to a couple of very smart hedge fund clients I have on the consulting side. They were saying, after you have, you know, some suggestions to try and figure out for when the market is switching from a low vol to a high vol regime or vice versa, or when a new explanatory variable is coming into the equation to look at dollar JPY or stocks. And that's very hard. I mean, getting these regime switching things is very hard. And what is true in the meantime is that if you're in a low vol environment and carry is king and you're getting paid to just be long risk premia, like, you know, your long equities and your long carry, and you get paid, that's a certainty. You do get paid. Going against that is basically just betting on this cycle to reverse. And if you don't have a catalyst, it means day by day, you will be slowly but surely slapped in your face, first gently, then more aggressively until you're stopped out. And it's a very hard game because you need to have a catalyst and you need to be able really to predict when the situation is about to turn. And that's very hard.
Yeah. And I think that's can often be a fool's game, as opposed to, like I said, just not even necessarily knowing it when you see it, but having some kind of framework or parameters where you say, okay, if this happens, I'm going to short Mexico, or if this moving average breaks, I'm going to short Mexico. But if it goes back below, dollar Mex goes back below, I'll get out. And just keeping it simple and having, like, because what people will get killed on is the too far too fast trade, right? Like, oh, this has come too far too fast. I mean, dude, if that's your thesis, that is not a good thesis. You know what I mean? Like, you have to have more than that. And it can sometimes just be a simple mathematical thing or whatever. I was actually surprised by your research, because I would have thought there'd be a point at which the sharp got high enough in a carry trade that maybe it would have some predictive value, but I'm not shocked, but I was a little bit surprised because
let's share a bit what I've done for people.
Sure.
So what happens here is, I looked at three assets: high yield bonds, Mexico, long Mexico, short Japan. So Mexico JPY FX carry trade, typical, and long S&P 500. Okay, three risk on positive risk premium or carry trades. And I had the feeling that the Sharpe ratio on this trade was very high today. And the feeling is correct. So these things have been printing returns at very low vol. So that means you're getting paid a lot of returns, not little volatility. It's been a great, great ride to be long risk assets, risk premium and carry. Then I wondered, hey, what if I backtest in the past 25, 30, 40 years, for every time the S&P 500 has gotten to a Sharpe ratio, which was very elevated, that must surely be a great leading indicator of a drawdown coming, right? Because the trade is so crowded, Brand. I mean, the Sharpe ratio on the S&P 500 rolling monthly now is 3.5. For your understanding, a good hedge fund has a Sharpe ratio of 1, 1.5. It's a great hedge fund in that case. The S&P has a 3.5 Sharpe ratio as we speak. So that must mean it's coming down, right? Went back 30 years, back tested every time, and you can find like 10, 12 episodes. 50% of the times, 3 months later, the S&P was down. 50% of the times, the S&P was up. And the average return is zero, and the median return is zero. Namely, it doesn't mean anything. It's just random. It's completely random. So sometimes...
Go ahead.
No, I was about to say, sometimes the S&P 500, 3 months later, after hitting a 3.5 sharp, kept going up and delivered a 6 or 7% positive returns in 3 months. It kept going up, and sometimes it nothing, and sometimes it went down 6%. It just helps you nada, nothing, zero, to predict whether it's going to shift. So that means that crowded trade can become more crowded and more crowded, and you can get stopped out. And it's very, very hard to predict when it changes tune.
So what I like about that piece is that I feel like a lot of analysts don't want to publish something that doesn't have a crazy shocking conclusion. Like, if it doesn't show a massive negative return, a lot of people will just say, oh, this is boring, and just put it away. And I mean, that's the whole problem with science and the replication crisis and P hacking and all that stuff, right? Is that if you only publish the super interesting stuff, there's going to be a massive bias in your publishing. But it's still useful to know that when the sharp of the S&P is at 3.5, that that's neither bullish nor bearish. I think that's still useful because a lot of people, I think your gut instinct would always be to think like, oh, it's massively outperforming, so it'll mean revert. But it's useful to know the null hypothesis that this condition, this starting condition, has no future forecasting value. I think that's a super useful thing to do. So I like that because I find people don't do that enough.
Such a boring podcast, man. We're getting excited about having no conclusions on anything. But anyway, I mean, people listen to us maybe just to hear two guys blubber about macro and trade ideas.
Important thing is for us to have fun.
That's fair enough. Now, talking about trade ideas, I'm going to say something. Since Brent and I restarted the podcast here, probably thrown at you like 4 or 5 trade ideas. So far, the hit rate's like 80%. I don't know, long gold or short dollar Brazil or Swiss JPY or other ideas. So please don't assume this is going to continue. I mean, we're going to be so wrong, and so often you're going to say, look at these two idiots. They were so wrong. But anyway, this was just a joke. So far, so good. But do you have anything on your plate or any recap or something you want to mention, Brent, this week?
Well, the thing that's on my radar most is, and I would describe it as mildly interesting because like it's something, I mean, you can trade it on interactive brokers or whatever. So it's just something that people don't trade that much. But I think it's mildly interesting because it may also have some signaling value is dollar CNH, which I call it CNH, which is the offshore version of the Chinese yuan that people can actually trade.
Yeah,
it's been in a really tight range this year. And without getting into like the nitty gritty of how it's managed by the PBOC, the People's Bank of China, generally they have a lot of influence over where it goes. And it's somewhat tightly managed to either a basket of currencies or to the US dollar. And then they'll intervene and stop it from going up if they don't want the Chinese currency to depreciate. So it's been very, very boring. Like they've basically been fixing it at the same rate for months. And the market tends to sort of anchor on the fixing rate that China uses. And the other day, I think it was last Friday, they fixed a little bit higher, which means higher dollar. And dollar China shot up. But then the next day they fixed lower. But dollar China actually never went back down. So again, that's one of those like, oh, something weird is happening here kind of situations where dollar China was 7.13, 7.23 all of 2024, which is a very narrow range. If you do the percentages, like whatever that is, I don't know. I can't do that in my head, but it's small. And now we're up around 7.26, which doesn't sound like a lot, but considering it's a managed currency pair, essentially, I mean, they don't manage the CNH directly, but they do indirectly. The fact that it's moving up, the ramifications generally are that they're loosening their grip. So obviously it's bullish dollar China, but then kind of circling back to what we were saying about carry and all that, it's very rare that you can have a long carry trade that is also long tail risk.
Yeah.
Like normally, if you want to be long the tail, you got to pay. It's like buying insurance, right? Like you don't buy S&P, you buy S&P puts and you pay through the nose and that's what you're getting. But the funny thing is with dollar CNH is that it's actually positive carry because US rates are much higher than Chinese rates. China's cutting, the Fed's not cutting yet anyways. And there's a play on the FDI and there's like a lot of fundamental reasons you would want to be short China, but everyone always knows that. And that's been the case since Evergrande in 2021. But what you have to do is again, find a timing catalyst. And to me, the fact that it hasn't retraced is bullish dollar China. And then that also makes it a little bit easier for the dollar to rally in general. But really the trade is just owning dollar China, either spot or you can buy options. And then eventually, I think it's almost a certainty that there'll be a freak out trade ahead of the election at some point. Obviously, it's way too early for that now. But the beauty of it is that you're getting paid to hold on to it. And like I said, it's very rare to be long a tail. So you're long the election tail. You're always long the Taiwan tail as well, being short China, but whatever. But to be long a tail and long carry is rare, and dollar China represents that. So even if it goes nowhere, you make money.
Yeah. Really like the way you phrase this, because ultimately you can be right or you can be wrong on the trade, but the merits is that it's a trade with an interesting reaction function to bad events. Idiosyncratic bad events in China, bad events geopolitically. So it has that profile. It feels like an insurance trade, but you don't pay for it. So that's not that bad. I would say it's pretty rare to get across some of these. For example, instead, a trade I wanted to mention, Brent, which is an insurance trade that costs quite some money, is to be in curve steepeners. So in the US, the curve steepener is very popular. People want to use, you know, they see these inverted curves and they say, what the hell? It must disinvert, either because the economy is strong or because the economy is weak. I don't know which one of the two, but it has to disinvert. That's basically what I hear the whole time, right? And well, fair enough, maybe it will. And I have, I think, what's the name? Bill Gross. Bill Gross has been talking about curve steepness for now 6 months. What he doesn't say is that he's paying to be in the trade because the trade is negative carry and it hits you in the face every morning that nothing happens in the US. And instead, the dollar CNH, in this case, it doesn't hit you. It actually showers you with this madly hot thing called carry every day that you can help your book with. Well, okay, I really like this, Brent, but in the interest of time, we also have a part of the podcast where we talk about some interesting stuff we have read and some very stupid stuff we have read. So this is the time.
All right. So usually I'm the stupid guy, but I'm going for smart this week.
Okay, cool.
So one thing that I think has helped me tremendously on the trading side in terms of not just psychology, but frameworks and just ways of thinking about thinking, like metacognition, all that kind of stuff, is reading adjacent things to investing and trading, because like after a while, I mean, after reading a lot of trading books, and I've written a couple as well, the themes tend to overlap a lot, obviously, right, in risk management and psychology of trading and all that. So I like to branch out into sort of adjacent areas like poker, sports, chess, things like that. And so I read Phil Galfond's daily, or sorry, it's not daily, but his newsletter. And he's one of the best poker players in the world. And he's kind of, I think he's viewed as one of the nice guys. You know, he's trying to help people. He's like an educator and a teacher. He's a good writer. And so his piece this week was called Three Essential Truths About Variance. And it's a really good piece. It definitely echoes some of the stuff that I talk about in Alpha Trader, which is it's really hard as a human being to appreciate how strong variance can be. So if you put your trading statistics into a simulator and you're like a 55% hit rate person with a 1.5-to-1 ratio of wins to losses, which are excellent ratios, you'll still have entire years where you lose money. And so I'll just read a very quick, like the very intro of it. He says, the human mind isn't built to handle variance well. We evolved to learn from our actions. A caveman only needs to put his hand in a fire once to learn to never do it again. That's a fast education. We take an action, we get a result, and we calibrate our actions based on that. Imagine if the caveman had two options, put his hand in fire, put his hand in cool water, but instead of things working the way they would in the real world, the fire burns him 70% of the time and the cool water burns him 30% of the time. It's going to be a lot harder to learn which the better option is. And then he goes on to explain some of that. But I think that's one of the fundamental erroneous aspects of finance, is that individuals and firms don't understand variance very well. And you can model it, and sometimes you can get a better understanding by running simulations and things like that. But if you hire someone at a hedge fund and 8 months later you say, this guy sucks, I'm getting rid of him, then you don't understand variance.
Yes, this is something so much true. I remember as well when I started taking risk, my mentor said, oh, okay, this is your first year. So these are the playground rules. You can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do that. Of course, you know, you need to be supervised when you start. And he said, by the way, I don't know, let's see in 3 to 4 years if you're good. And I'm like, 3 to 4 years, man, I'll show you now. And he's like, now what, man? It's, you know, in the first year, it can be luck. You know, the variance is so big with your strategy, on any strategy, actually, that it's actually mostly luck on a short time frame. It's a hard truth for many, but it's actually true. Hey, something very stupid I read this week, and fun, very fun as well. So on Twitter, there is this thing going on. Do you know the DJT ETF, the Donald J. Trump ETF, media thingy? I don't even know exactly what it represents, but it is.
It's the blue chip of blue chips.
The blue, so very blue. Orange, maybe, like Trump's hair. The very orange ETF. Yeah. So, okay, sure. It's going up every day, up and up and up and up and up. And at some point, somebody said on Twitter, this is a bubble, I'm going to short it. And then he also added, well, if I look at the borrow of this thing, it's like 250% borrow cost. So, holy crap, I don't want that. Fair enough. I can follow so far. And then the guy said, I found a way to avoid the borrow cost. How does that work? I'm going to buy a put option. Oh, and then a few guys said, dude, that's not how it works. You know, in a put option, there's going to be the implied borrow as well, factored in. I mean, nobody's stupid. They're not giving you a free lunch, the put sellers. And he went on and you know, tried to defend this thing on and on and on and on. And then at some point you had very smart option market making guys that are on Twitter. You know, Twitter, there's a bunch of bozos in there, but also very smart people in there. And you know, they tried to make a point. And he was like, no, guys, you don't understand anything. You know, I'm buying put options. There is no cost of borrow there. That was fun and stupid.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit painful. That reminds me actually of one of the stupidest things I ever did in finance was I was thinking about the ultra short and ultra long ETFs and how many of them go down over time because of the slippage. And there's a lot of reasons, negative variance or negative hedging problems and stuff. And so if you looked at a chart of the ultra long oil and the ultra short oil, they're actually both going down over many years. And so I actually back tested and created like a whole strategy of if you go short both of these things, you make so much money. And I did it with a bunch of them. And I was like, oh my God, I found the holy grail. And then I showed it to the guy that sat next to me. And he's like, yeah, but dude, you don't have transaction costs. I was like, oh boy.
As you can see, we're very good at self-deprecating here. Sometimes we make mistakes, but we share them with you so that you can appear a bit smarter with your colleagues and your bosses that Brent and I are. Said that, I would say that there is nothing else to add from my side, Brent. Shall we say goodbye for this week?
All right. Happy Easter, everyone.
Happy long weekend. Enjoy. And we'll speak again next week.
All right. See you in April.
The content provided on the Macro Trading Floor podcast is for general information purposes only. No information or other content provided in this podcast should be considered as investment advice. Seek independent professional consultation in the form of legal, financial, and fiscal advice before making any investment decision. Always perform your own due diligence.